on this webinar. Clearly, you're not webinar weary and are still working hard to keep your businesses and employees on track despite the looming Easter break. I'm Ginny Hallam, Managing Director of Halborns and a senior employment lawyer dedicated to providing advice and support to the builders merchant sector. I'm joined by fellow director Rena Christie, another senior lawyer within the team who has kindly been willing to share with me the preparation and responsibility for this webinar. Now, I usually start my training sessions by running through the fire drill. All I can say is hopefully you've made sure the oven is off, the cup of tea is secure, and the kids aren't killing each other. We've not had a chance to practice this session, but we'll do our very best to ensure it runs to time. We've picked the top 10 questions we're being asked as employment lawyers from the sector, and we're going to give you guidance along with practical and commercial suggestions. Now, I should say that this is just guidance. It's not advice. To give you direct advice, we need to know the specific circumstances, which, of course, we'd be delighted to support you with. But this, just to reiterate, is guidance from Halborns and from Rena and myself. If you want to ask questions, you can either use the tool on the webinar or at the end of the webinar. We have a slide with our info at address. Now, don't forget to leave your email address, as we'll get back to you in person afterwards, depending on the number of questions that we receive. We're delivering this session for you for free, but we would ask that if you enjoy the session and find it useful, that you contribute to our Just Giving page, in respect of which we'll circulate the link after the session. We are asking for suggestions on preferred charities, particularly those supporting the NHS. Now, if you're having technical problems and either can't hear us or are struggling to see the slides, if you could email Paige Godsell at the BNF, she'll try and support you with those technical issues. But don't worry, this webinar is being recorded, so you can listen to your heart's content over the Easter break, should you prefer to do so. Although we're not providing a transcript or doing a transcript, most of the information that we're talking you through today is either on our website, which is at www.halborns.com, or it's within our frequently asked questions, which we've produced and keep up to date for our clients. If you'd like a copy, then please just email us and we can talk you through how that works. So I'm going to hand over to Rena, who is going to provide you with guidance in respect of our top five most asked questions. And then I'll be picking up on the further five questions after Rena. Over to you, Rena.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the introduction, Ginny. So shall we kick off with the first question? I anticipate that we might see a downturn in deliveries if this goes on for much longer. I want to avoid furloughing employees where possible. What are my options? So before we jump into the alternatives that are available, we thought it would be useful to give you a quick overview of the coronavirus job retention scheme so that we can understand why employers may want to explore other options as opposed to furlough. So in terms of the coronavirus job retention scheme, it's a temporary scheme open to all UK employers who had started a PAYE payroll scheme on the 28th of February this year, have enrolled for PAYE online, and have a UK bank account. Under the scheme, you'll be able to apply online to HMRC to claim for 80% of any furloughed employee's gross monthly wage costs, subject to a monthly maximum of £2,500. In addition, you can also claim for employer national insurance contributions and minimum auto-enrolment employer pension contributions on that reduced wage. That's only applicable for individuals who were on your PAYE payroll on the 28th of February. So unfortunately, if they joined after this date, they won't be eligible. Now, where an employee is furloughed, they cannot do any work for you whatsoever. So that means that if you need somebody to check emails or pick up the post on your site, they wouldn't be able to do that either. And if you are going to put an employee on furlough, it has to be for a minimum period of 3 weeks. Now, we've had a further update to date that the HMRC portal will open on the 20th of April and that the first payments are going to be made on the 30th of April. So quite some time from when the scheme will be backdated to in terms of 1st of March being the first date that you could furlough somebody. So you can see already that there's some inflexibility with the approach under the scheme, and that might be why you want to look at alternatives in this scenario, especially where you've still got a demand for some work to be undertaken. So let's explore some of those alternatives together. Within your contractual terms, so either in your employment contract or a contractual policy that you have, you may have the right to temporarily lay off employees or put them on short-time working. Now, for those of you who are using the BMF Intelligent Employment Template, you'll see that clause in the handbook, and you'll have it in there. What's important to flag is that if you don't have the contractual right to put employees on layoff or short-time working, and you still do so, you'll actually be in breach of contract, entitling the employee to resign and pursue an unfair dismissal claim against you where they've got 2 years service or more. So again, layoff and short-time working might not be familiar terms, so I'll just take you through what they are. In terms of layoff, that's where you ask an employee not to do any work for a period of time, and in return, they're not entitled to any pay from you for that period. So that's different to the furlough scheme, where obviously, cash flow wise, you would need to pay that 80% figure that we talked about until you're able to recover that from the government. So that might be something that you want to explore. And again, unlike furlough, if you are going to put employees on layoff, there's no minimum time that you need to do that for. So again, subject to the work demands that you've got, it might be that you lay off an employee for a 1 week period. Short time working is slightly different. So that's where you ask an employee to work reduced hours and they then receive prorated pay based on the hours that they work. So again, it's much more flexible in terms of being able to meet the work demands that you have, because you can ask employees to work reduced hours just for that work. Now, what I would flag just briefly is that there's no minimum period as to how long an employee can be on either layoff or short-time working, or a combination of the two. But the only thing that I'd flag is that if they are on layoff or short-time working for 4 weeks in a row or 6 weeks within a 13-week period, they might be entitled to ask for redundancy pay. So just watch out for that, in particular where you've got long-standing employees, or employees that were thinking of leaving anyway or maybe retiring. A couple of other options that might be available to you aside of layoff and short-time working might be asking employees to take unpaid leave. Where you don't have the contractual right to do that, again, you'll need their consent in the same way as you would for layoff and short-time working, so just bear that in mind. Finally, another option that might be worth exploring is requiring employees to use their holiday entitlement. So for example, if you haven't got enough work to give them to fill their entire working week, but you could fill most of it, you might ask them to take a day's holiday to reduce their working hours during that week. Now, in respect of how you can ask them to use their holiday entitlement, you'll need to look at your contractual terms in order to understand what level of notice you need to give them to require them to take holiday. If you don't have anything in your contract terms, that's fine. You can give them double the amount of notice of the holiday that you want them to take. So effectively, if you wanted them to take 1 day's holiday, you'd give them 2 days notice to do so. And then finally, and I guess the much more nuclear approach would be making redundancies. So if you consider that you're over-resourced and that you need to downsize your workforce to reflect the reduced workload that you have, that might be an option that you want to take. The only thing that I'd flag in respect of that is bear in mind that if you're proposing to make 20 or more dismissals at one particular site within a 90-day period, and that would include withdrawing job offers, that you might trigger obligations for collective consultation, which then means that there's a prescribed process that you need to follow. I won't take you through that in any detail, as it's quite a complex process, other than to flag to you that there's then minimum timeframes that you would need to consult with employees for, the shortest of which being 30 days. And there are significant penalties for getting it wrong, so it's well worth being aware of those trigger points. So moving on to the next question. We're getting complaints from employees still at work who are worried about their safety. How should we manage these conversations? Now, we're all watching the news probably more closely than ever, and there doesn't appear to be much else on the TV, to be honest. And we can see that there is a rising number of confirmed cases. So you may well start hearing concerns from employees, if you haven't already, about concerns in catching the virus at work and not wanting to be at work for that reason. Now, understanding the reasons for their concerns is going to be really, really important here, because by understanding what their reasons are, that will then determine what your obligations are to the employee, what rights the employee has, and importantly, what action you can then take. So it might just be that they prefer to stay at home and ride this out in the comfort of their own home and on the sofa, or it might be that they've got genuine concerns about getting to and from work safely. Or another one that we see quite often over the last couple of weeks is that actually they or someone that they care for fall within a vulnerable group or a shielded group. And then finally, and the one to be most cautious of, and I'll take you through all these in turn in a moment, is they might be concerned about unsafe practices at work. So let's run through each of those in turn, taking you through your options. So the first one, which is perhaps the easiest, is the group of individuals that are fit and healthy, so they don't fall within a vulnerable group, but would just prefer to stay at home during this pandemic because they are worried generally about catching the virus. Now, the important thing to note here is there is no legal right for them to be able to do so. So just because they are concerned about catching the virus generally doesn't mean that they are able to stay at home. And what I would say in that respect is that if they are concerned, explain to them why it is safe for them to be at work. So in terms of social distancing and the measures that you're taking. And I would be explaining to them that failing to attend work for that group of individuals will be treated in accordance with your usual formal processes. In respect of any pay that they'd be entitled to, if they don't attend work, you don't need to pay them because they're not ready, willing and able to be at work. So the second group of individuals, so they individuals that are worried about getting to and from work safely, for example, if they rely on public transport, if they're worried about getting public transport to and from work or travelling to and from work generally, you need to consider whether it's possible for them to perform their role from home. I appreciate that might not be ideal, but the current government guidance makes it very clear that where a role can be performed at home, it should be. Now, if theirs is a role that can't be performed at home and they or a dependent don't fall within a vulnerable group, so for all intents and purposes, that they're fit and healthy or considered to be low risk, you need to explain to them and make it clear that you still require them to attend work at your premises whilst adhering to social distancing, of course, and why it's not possible for them to perform their role at work. Now, again, if they're concerned about getting to and from work, it might be the case that, you know, they need to get an earlier bus into work when it's quieter to miss the traffic or might even need to walk into work. But if they're not options, it doesn't mean that you can allow them not to be at work. So there's no requirement for you to do so. So again, failure to attend work for this group can be dealt with in the usual way under your formal processes, and any non-attendance can be unpaid. Now, in respect of a group of individuals that fall within a vulnerable group, they're the individuals that are over 70, pregnant or with an underlying health condition. They are identified as being within a vulnerable group. So that's different to the individuals that have received a letter over the last week from the NHS stating that they need to be shielded. We'll come on to those in a moment. So if the employee or a dependent of theirs falls within the vulnerable group, they are likely to be protected for employment law purposes. So that might be because of their age, so pregnancy or disability discrimination. Now, while there's no government guidance setting out that this group shouldn't work, if they tell you that they'd prefer not to, then you should try and accommodate their request in light of the fact that they're going to have this protected characteristic from a discrimination point of view. And if you can't accommodate their request, then you need to show that you've got sound business reasons as to why you can't do that, and also why there's very little risk of them being able to catch the virus at work. So again, talking about the measures that you're taking, and in particular in respect of social distancing. You might also want to ask them for relevant paperwork to evidence that they or a dependent fall within a vulnerable group. So we're seeing much more cases of employees suggesting that they fall within a vulnerable group for conditions that they had historically, years ago. So it might be well worth asking for that paperwork. Now, if you do accept their request not to attend work, which as I've mentioned, you're not obligated to, There is no entitlement for them to be paid during that leave or to receive any sick pay unless they are in fact sick. If, however, the individual is or a dependent of theirs is somebody that is shielding, the position is slightly different. So if they've received, one of the 1.5 million people that received a letter stating that they shouldn't leave their house for a period of 12 weeks, you have to allow this group to remain away from work. Now, again, there's no right to be paid during this period unless they are covered by a sick note, in which case they're entitled to be covered and paid in accordance with your sick pay policy. However, you might want to consider furloughing any shielded employee or a carer of theirs where they are at risk. But all I would say in respect of that is the guidance has changed slightly over the weekend. And in respect of shielding those individuals, there is now a requirement for them to be at risk of redundancy. So it's worth chatting that one through if that's something that you want to explore. And then finally, if the individuals don't want to attend work and are reluctant to do so because they are concerned about unsafe practices at work, and that can be failure to comply with health and safety laws generally, or in respect of the COVID-19 guidance, it's important to understand whether there's any truth to those concerns. Now, if there isn't, it's important to address fully their concerns and explain to the employee how you are meeting your legal obligations. Because if you take them through a formal process without doing so, they could argue that they've suffered a detriment as a result of raising those health and safety concerns and blowing the whistle, and could in fact resign and say that their resignation is an automatically unfair dismissal because they had no option but to leave your employment. So just watch out for that. So moving on to the next question, question 3. I've been approached by a great driver who is currently furloughed from another business. Can I take them on? Well, we're all looking for talented individuals. And if you found someone that's great for your team, the good news is that you can take them on, providing that the individual is allowed to do so by their current employer, even while they're on furlough. There are a few things that you need to bear in mind though before taking them on. So just because the employee has told you they're allowed to work for you doesn't necessarily mean that they are. Now, the reason that that's an issue, because you might think, well, that's their problem with their employer. And to a large extent it is. However, their employer could also pursue you for encouraging them to breach their contract if they think that you were aware that they weren't allowed to work elsewhere. So for that reason, it's just something to watch out for. In addition, their current employer might well think that you're trying to poach their employee. So they might be reluctant to let them come and work for a competitor. So something to bear in mind. And while they are working for you, the usual rules of employment apply. So they'll continue to accrue holiday and they'll be entitled to a minimum notice period after a month of working for you, despite the fact that they are furloughed from somewhere else. In respect of the next steps in dealing with how you take that individual on, just a few things to bear in mind. So the first thing that I'd be doing is ascertaining with the individual, are they allowed to work from you? What you might want to do is even write to the employer or ask the employee to get written confirmation that they can share with you so that you're satisfied about that. And also you might want to speak directly with their employer to reassure them that you're not trying to coach them and that you're just utilising them for this short-term period. You'll also want to think about what type of contract you put the individual on. So as you know, they're furloughed from another business. So presumably their contract is going to be for a fixed term for the duration of their furlough. Now, from a practical point of view, just bear in mind that you might not get the usual notice from the individual when they're leaving your employment, because they might not be given a great deal of notice as to when their furlough is going to come to an end. We're regularly seeing employers drafting letters saying that they'll only give employees, you know, a day's notice of when their furlough might end. So just watch out for that. And then from a practical point of view, if you are putting them on a contract, you might also want to think about that contract being a 0 hours contract to again give you flexibility as to what hours you give them if any, bearing in mind that the current climate is changing, you know, on a weekly, if not daily basis, as is the government advice. And then from an administrative point of view, if you are taking an individual on in this period, think about the usual onboarding and health and safety processes to make sure that they're all set up in the right way for a fast start. And also they'll need to complete the HMRC new starter checklist, and in particular statement C on that checklist, which confirms that they've got another job. Finally, in taking the individual on, as it will be after the 28th of February deadline, just bear in mind that you won't be able to furlough them from this job. Okay, question four. We've managed to ask a few employees to work from home, but they take ages to answer their phone and don't appear to be productive. What are my options for managing them? So managing employees remotely might be something completely new for your managers. Might not be something that they're used to, or they might have had to only do it for kind of one individual in the past. So we're all working in a very new way. I think the first thing that I would start off by saying is that in terms of managing remotely, there are some helpful tips to bear in mind and some helpful reminders. So the first one is managing output and reminding managers to focus on what that output is, as opposed to the individual tasks that the employee is doing on a constant basis. Because quite honestly, you can't see what they're doing. So it's quite different in terms of being in the office with them or being on site with them. And in terms of those outputs, make sure that the manager is clearly communicating with the individual and with the employee about what the expected outcomes are, and also the timeframes that they need to deliver those, so that the employee is really clear on what they need to do to succeed. The other obvious one that quite sometimes gets missed is communication. So naturally, when you are working alongside somebody physically, you communicate much more effectively, you pick things up, you overhear conversations, so information flows much more organically. Unfortunately, with working from home, that's just not possible, and employees can sometimes be cut off from that flow of information. So making sure that the manager is sharing information with them that's going to, again, support them to succeed in their role, so perhaps diarying a daily meeting or a weekly meeting, however that role is structured. And then finally, giving active feedback. So again, because they're not in the same place together and they're not able to discuss things in real time, quite often we're communicating via emails, which isn't ideal. Making sure that they put time in to give feedback, again, for the employee to know in real time what they could be doing differently in order to succeed. Now, I fully understand that, you know, you might have done all of those things, and unfortunately the individual is still not meeting the clear expectations that you've put for them. They're not following the workload and the output that they need to be doing, and perhaps they're sat in the garden sunbathing in this gorgeous sunshine. Now, if that's the case and we think that they're underperforming or taking the biscuits, what we might want to do is and what you're perfectly entitled to do is take them through your usual performance management process. So have a look at what your policy says in terms of performance management and follow it. So usual rules apply. Now, I appreciate that probably as you're flicking through your policy, it will refer to arranging meetings and posting letters, which might not be very possible at the moment, bearing in mind social distancing rules. So if you can't have a face-to-face meeting, that's fine. You can still tee up formal meetings over the phone or by video call. All I would say is that consider setting those up as a conference call so that other people can dial in. So for example, if it is a formal meeting, the employee has the right to be accompanied, so they might want another colleague to dial into that call. The other practical point that I would flag in respect of that is that if you are having a meeting remotely, just bear in mind that anything that you're saying might be recorded and you're not sure who else is listening on the line. So just watch out for that. Obviously, you can make it clear that there shouldn't be anybody else doing so, but it's pretty impossible to police it. Although in theory, nobody else should be in their house with them while social distancing. So I suppose that's a good thing. And then question five. So, if we do need to furlough employees, how do I choose who to furlough and who keeps working? Now, the important thing to mention here, it is entirely your choice as the employer who you are going to designate as a furloughed employee. So, employees don't have the right to insist that they become a furloughed employee. It's your choice. That being said, when you are making that decision about who to furlough and who not to, you need to do so in compliance with employment law and also the terms of the employees' contracts. So let's talk about employment contracts first. Now, the reality is, bearing in mind that furlough wasn't a term that any of us had even heard of 2 weeks ago, you won't have anything in your employment contract setting out what you need to do in terms of determining who to furlough. But it's well worth having a look at it, because there might be rules around layoffs and short-time working that determine the process that you should be following. But as I say, unlikely. So in terms of taking into account employment law, the first one to talk about is the relationship between you and the employee and the trust and confidence they're entitled to place in you. Now, every employee has the implied rights to put their trust and confidence in you to deal with employment matters reasonably and lawfully. So if you select one employee over another without having an objective justification for doing so, then actually the employee might turn around and say that you've breached that trust and confidence by behaving in that way, giving them the right to resign and claim unfair dismissal where they've got more than 2 years service. Now, selecting employees on the basis of performance, so where you've properly recorded and measured their performance previously, or their experience in the role, qualifications, these are all good starting points for objective selection, so think about those. We have heard some employees talking about first in, last out. Just bear in mind that that might open the door there for arguments around age discrimination, because younger employees are going to be the first to be furloughed in that instance. Discrimination wise, there are some risks in terms of how you apply the criteria. So be careful to ensure that any criteria you're applying to select who is affected as a furloughed employee isn't discriminatory, and that you can objectively justify why you're taking that decision. So if you discriminate against any employee, they can resign and claim constructive unfair dismissal, and they can also bring a discrimination claim. Now, there are some selection criteria that are going to be considered quite obviously as discriminatory. So just to run through briefly what they might be, we talked about experience already. Another one that we're seeing quite often is deciding to furlough employees with childcare responsibilities. But that's more likely to be women, and therefore that could again be seen to be discriminatory, as another example. And then also using sickness absence records. So if you are furloughing employees who have had a greater amount of sickness absence, again, that could be discriminatory to employees who are disabled for employment law purposes, because having a disability is much more likely to mean that they have a greater deal of absence and therefore they're furloughed. Now, you might be thinking, why would anybody be complaining about being furloughed? And actually, surely what we're hearing is it's great, it's a form of paid leave. But there are employees that feel that that means that their job is in some way at risk on the back of being furloughed. So they're more likely to be at risk of redundancy. That creates job insecurity for them. And obviously, they are under the government grant receiving less pay unless you decide to top up their pay to full pay. So handing over to Ginny to take you through the next set of questions.
Thanks very much, Renna. So question 6, is there anything furloughed employees can be doing for us whilst not at work? Can I ask them to do training, for example? Well, it might be tempting, but the Government Guide for Employees confirms that once you are on furlough, you will not be able to work for your employer. And government guidance for employers says that you cannot ask your employee to do any work that either makes money for your business or provides services for your organisation. So this means that they can't collect the post, they shouldn't be keeping an eye on their inbox, they shouldn't be taking deliveries. The government guidance is very clear on this. And if you fail to follow that government guidance, then you are putting at risk the reimbursement that you should otherwise have received under the job retention scheme. But there are things that the employee can be doing whilst furloughed. So one of which is that they can take part in volunteer work, even if you've organised that for them. If they're a director, they can carry out their statutory obligations. Now, there's no guidance from the government as to what statutory obligations means, but we'd imagine that their duties under the Companies Act 2006, including perhaps attending annual general meeting, updating company records. But importantly, again, the furloughed director must not generate income or carry out a service for the company. Equally, the employee or the director that's furloughed can take part in training as long as they do not provide services in doing so or make money during the training or as a result of it. Now, just to be clear, that means that they can't, for example, deliver training like we are doing today. I hasten to add, we're not furloughed. They can't turn the training that they've received into a training guide or a manual during furlough. Now, of course, they could do that after furlough, but not during furlough. So they couldn't be turning what they've learnt into a document that you could then use in the future. But obviously, anything that they've learnt during the training that they can then use for your business once the furloughs come to an end, then of course they can use that in the future. So really the best thing to remember is that in terms of training, it's really there just to absorb new learning whilst they're off and do nothing further with it. Now, if you are interested in providing your furloughed employees with training, then do remember that those employees need to be paid at least the national minimum wage or living wage or apprenticeship minimum in respect to that training, or usually what they'd be paid under their contract for any time that they work. Now, in terms of VAT payments, if the amount of the training that they've received means that their pay is going to exceed either the 80% that you're going to get back from the government or the 2,500, then you're going to need to top up the additional pay that you need to provide to that trained furloughed employee, okay? The final point on this is we're recommending that you keep quite a careful record of your instructions to furloughed employees not to work. Clearly, this is an area where reimbursement under the job retention scheme could be prejudiced. So it's very important if you are audited by HMRC that you have a record to show that you clearly instructed your employees not to work. And this is something that you could perhaps do on a regular weekly basis just to make sure that you're all on the same page. So question seven. I'm really confused by holiday and furlough at the moment. Is there any clarification on whether furloughed employees can take holiday? Well, the reason why we're also confused as the position in respect of holiday and furloughed working is because the government were completely silent in their guidance until recently as to what holiday was accrued, could be paid, and could be taken during furlough leave. So taking accrual of holiday, first of all, the starting point is to say that all employees accrue 28 days holiday during furlough if they're full-time, and clearly that's a prorated amount if they're part-time. They're also very likely to accrue any additional holiday that you provide to them in addition to the statutory 28 days, unless you've agreed something different with them. And I've not seen many employers that have agreed something different. So mostly the starting point will be that usual holiday is accrued during furlough. Now, in terms of taking that holiday, the government have now been clear, and this is only recent, along with ACAS, that employees can take holiday during furlough. So the bank holidays that we've got coming up tomorrow and Monday, those holidays can be taken during furlough. However, unhelpfully, neither ACAS nor the government have been clear on whether employees that are on furlough who take holiday will therefore interrupt the 3-week furlough period, meaning that you then don't receive the reimbursement under the job retention scheme for that entire 3-week period. So we haven't got a complete answer from HMRC or the government or ACAS at the moment as to whether employees that take holiday during a furlough leave 3-week period will then mean that you don't recover the entire reimbursement in respect of that 3-week period. Now, we're expecting guidance later today in an HMRC tweet that confirms the government's approach, and obviously we'll keep everybody up to date with our updates as to once we've had confirmation as to how this will all be treated by the government. For what it's worth, my view, and again, this is not advice, it's just my view, is that employees taking holiday during the 3-week furlough period are unlikely to mean that you then can't secure the reimbursement for that entire 3-week period. So I'd suggest that if you allow employees to take holiday during a three week furlough period, that you should then secure in the same way the reimbursement under the job retention scheme. But we don't know that for sure, and we're waiting for HMRC guidance. So if you want to take a more cautious approach and you don't want to risk losing the 3 week reimbursement, you've got a number of different options. So you could either stop employees from taking holiday during a furlough period and ask them to take it at the beginning of the period or at the end. Or alternatively, within the furlough letters that you send out to employees, you could confirm that if you don't receive the reimbursement from the job retention scheme in respect of the money that you're paying to your employees whilst furloughed, you can recover that money from the employee at some point in the future. Now, whether or not your employees agree to that is a different matter, but that is a possibility that you could include within your letters. Turning to holiday pay, so again, very recently, the government have now set out and been clear that the employee is entitled to 100% of normal pay based on the pay that they received pre-furlough. So their usual pay, 100% of their usual pay. Now, sadly, the government haven't been clear on whether they will contribute 80% towards that pay under the job retention scheme. And again, we're hoping for further guidance on that. For employees whose pay varies, whether it's because they have differing hours or perhaps guaranteed overtime, then a week's holiday pay for any holiday taken since the 6th of April should be calculated on an average of the last 52 weeks' pay, but not including any period of furlough. So discount any non-worked weeks in calculating that 52-week average. And what happens if there's not enough time within the holiday year for the employee to take the annual leave? Well, I'm sure you're all aware that the government have relaxed the rules on carrying over holidays so that any employee who cannot take their holiday in the current holiday year due to coronavirus will automatically be able to carry that holiday over to the next two holiday years beyond the holiday year in which the holiday was lost. So if you think about an example, if they lost holiday, they couldn't take holiday because of coronavirus in the holiday year ending the 31st of March 2020, then they'll have until the 31st of March 2022 to take the lost holiday because of the coronavirus. So moving on to our next question. So previous government guidance said I could furlough shielding employees, but now says I need to show I'd have made them redundant in order to do so. How do I do that? Well, the first thing to explain is what a shielding employee or a shielding individual is. And that's somebody who has been directly contacted by NHS England in writing and been strongly advised to stay at home at all times and avoid any face-to-face contacts for a period of at least 12 weeks. That would include individuals perhaps that have had organ transplants, they might have severe respiratory conditions or specific rare diseases. A full list is available on the government website. Now, the starting point in respect to shielding employees, if you want to furlough them, is get evidence of that letter. You want to see evidence that they've been designated by the government as a shielded employee. Now, last weekend, the government guidance was updated in respect of shielding employees and now says that shielded employees can only be furloughed where they would otherwise have been made redundant. Now, this is a really strange addition to the government guidance, bearing in mind that previous guidance specifically called out shielded employees and explained that they could absolutely be furloughed without this requirement to show that they would have otherwise been made redundant. It's equally odd because everybody else can be furloughed, provided that they meet with the set criteria, without showing that they would otherwise have been made redundant. So it's a very strange approach that the government have taken, and I suspect there might be an about turn on this, but again, we don't know that for sure. But we are where we are, so you'll need to consider for each employee that you furloughed or want to furlough as a result of them shielding, whether you can show that shielded employees' job has disappeared or that you need fewer of the role that they're doing. And that can be the case even if it's just due to the current coronavirus situation. You may well anticipate that in the future, that individual might well have a job to return to once the lights have come back on and the crisis that we're going through at the moment is over. But if you can show that that shielded employee's job has disappeared or you need fewer of the role and they've not been replaced, importantly, so you've not had to get somebody back in to replace what they were doing, then you're probably going to have a redundancy situation that means that you can furlough that shielded employee. If you can't do that, so if you don't think that you've got a redundancy situation, then you might well be able to rely on the new rights to furlough an employee where they have caring responsibilities. So if that shielded employee is caring for a dependent, even if it's just children that are no longer at school, then you are entitled to furlough that individual without showing that there's a redundancy situation. So if an individual is shielded but caring for dependents needs to be furloughed, then you don't need to show that there's a redundancy situation for that individual. Alternatively, and this is slightly more draconian, you could bring them off furlough and consider unpaid leave, layoff, or obviously them working from home if they're able to do that. The other alternative and the other option that you're left with is again writing to that shielded employee and saying, look, we'll furlough you, but if it's the case that we don't receive the reimbursement from the job retention scheme, then you might have to pay us back or allow us to recover back from you, maybe offsetting against future pay, any pay that you've received during the furlough period. Quite a difficult message to land with furloughed employees, but clearly something you could agree with them in writing if that's the route that you chose to go down. So on to our penultimate question. So I've had a request from a previous employee to rehire and place him on furlough. He left on the 29th of February. How do I respond to his request? Now, certainly for our larger clients, but this isn't just unique to big clients, big companies, we've had a lot of individuals, a lot of employees who perhaps have watched Martin Lewis's programs and consider that where they left your employment on the 29th of February or beyond, they have the right to return to your employment and be furloughed if perhaps a future job offer has been pulled or retracted. Now, if you decide to rehire an employee who stopped working for you on or after the 29th of February, then the government guidance is clear. That employee can be furloughed, provided that they meet with the usual furlough criteria, like that they're not going to be doing any work for you. But bear in mind that returning and rehiring a furloughed employee, they may still accrue 2 years service once they've been rehired. Now, if you take somebody back on and they accrue the 2 years service once they've been rehired, that would then give them the rights to an unfair dismissal claim and a statutory redundancy payment, along with other rights. There's also the possibility that despite the fact that you've rehired them and furloughed them in exactly the way that you see fit, HMRC finds a loophole in the particular circumstances and decides not to reimburse you their furloughed pay. You equally will have to pay that furloughed, rehired employee in advance of receiving the reimbursement. So it could cause cash flow issues, clearly, in doing so. Likewise, the rehired employee, if they chose to leave before, if they resigned from your employment, or alternatively, if they were dismissed, clearly they might not be in the frame of mind to be a great employee when they return. And it could be that you're then faced with perhaps a data subjects access request under the Data Protection Act, maybe complaints of discrimination, maybe a grievance, maybe whistleblowing. If the employee is trying to case build to support their future income and perhaps see you as an opportunity to do so, then of course in rehiring them, even if you do furlough them, that gives them the opportunity to bring a claim. And in addition, any employee that's rehired and furloughed will continue to accrue holiday and will need to be given statutory minimum notice at the very least if they work for you for at least 4 weeks. So that's not to say any of this within any of this that you shouldn't do this. And clearly from a moral perspective, you may feel that that's the right thing to do. It's just to flag to you some of the issues that you might come across and might have to deal with in rehiring and then furloughing an employee that had otherwise left your employment. Now, if you do decide not to rehire a departed employee, and decide that you are not going to take them back on, there are plenty of positive steps that you could take to support them. You could perhaps give them access to some online training support for free, maybe support them with CV drafting, with interview skills. You could connect them to voluntary groups where actually showing a future employer that they didn't sit around doing nothing but supported the community might be helpful for their CV. Anything that you can do, perhaps giving them a wider reference, a more detailed reference, setting out the responsibility and the role that they did before they left, again, should support them with future employment. And equally, there are jobs still out there. So if you connect them to an agency that was recruiting for popular roles at the moment, then at least they might be able to secure an income in the meantime whilst they're securing their next job opportunity. So hopefully you're still with us. We're on to our final question. So business is starting to pick up and I want to take someone off furlough. How do I do that? Well, we will all get there, I'm sure. So you'll need to let that employee know in writing that their furlough is coming to an end. And you'll need to give them reasonable notice of their return. Now, their contracts of employment might set out what reasonable notice is. You might have equally explained that in your furlough letter. And if neither is the case, then 2 or 3 days should be enough, depending on personal circumstances. You'll want to confirm the dates that they return, and you'll also want to communicate any continued changes to their work or to their contract of employment beyond that point, so beyond the point that they return. They might well have questions in respect of social distancing and measures that you're taking to keep them safe, and clearly, you know, explaining either with a coronavirus policy or a social distancing policy, the steps that you're taking to ensure their health and safety is maintained will be important to encourage them back to work and that fast start that Rena was talking about. And the final point to say is that obviously, just bear in mind that if you ask and require them to return to work before the completion of the 3 week furlough period, so if they haven't yet completed 3 weeks on furlough, then you won't then recover the reimbursement from the government under the job retention scheme. So if you need them back sooner, say perhaps they've only been on furlough for 2 weeks, then that 2 week furlough period will not be covered by the government's job retention scheme. So that marks an end of our questions and answers. I really hope that you found our time together this afternoon helpful. There is lots more information on our website. We're doing daily updates. If you're not getting them and would like them, then by all means let us know and we'll include you on those updates. As I say, our website is www.halbourns.com. If you think you'd find our frequently asked questions with lots more information about how you deal with these challenging situations, then do let us know. We provide you with more information about that. We will circulate our link in respect to the Just Giving page. Hopefully you've been able to hear that there's been a good deal of preparation that's gone on to this webinar. So if you are at all minded to contribute to charity, and again, like I say, do feel free to recommend a charity of your choice, then that would be very much appreciated. But rest assured that we will choose a charity that supports NHS workers during this challenging time in respect of your donations. Watch this space in respect of more webinars and updates, and stay safe and happy Easter. Thank you.